Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, online editor. This week, we'll be discussing what Hillary Clinton's America could look like, and we'll be speaking to Tristram Hunt on Labour's England problem. We'll also be hearing from Douglas Murray, who will be announcing the winner of his President Erdogan offensive poetry competition. First up, what should we expect from a Hillary Clinton presidency? I'm joined by Christopher Buckley and Freddie Gray to discuss. So, Christopher, isn't it the case at the moment that there are many conservatives and many Republicans who want anyone but Trump?
The answer is yes. What we're essentially being handed is a Hobson's choice, and perhaps the mother of all Hobson's choices. Yeah. As the proposition in logic goes, who says A must say B? If you, as a conservative, say A, I could under no circumstances vote for Donald Trump, you are in effect saying B. One of these two people is going to be president, barring some really unforeseen event. But at the moment, you know, we seem to be going through some kind of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross progression of, you know, anger, acceptance, denial, rejection, and finally coming to terms with it. There are a lot of things you can say. She's very bright. She has Maggie Thatcher levels of energy. She does her homework. Yes, the elite of Whitehall would be much, much, much more comfortable with her. I mean, who wouldn't be than with this orange maniac? But the trouble is that she's dull. We must confront the essential fact about Hillary is that she is interesting only as a phenomenon, as a kind of, if you will, American Evita, only, you know, without the balcony. She is not interesting.
I suppose the only positive for Trump is that he is interesting.
Well, yeah, Hitler was interesting. Mussolini was interesting. Up to a point, Lord Copper, unbearably so. We are at this juncture because Trump understands how to be entertaining. So our choices are to be wildly entertained or to be bored. You choose. It's a tough one.
Freddie, normally British prime ministers stay out of American elections. Can you imagine them coming out in support of Hillary?
I think so. I mean, I suppose it depends how successful Trump is at sort of reinventing himself as a possible president. But yes, I think the appetite for virtue signaling in Britain, and particularly among Britain's politicians, is so great that they won't be able to resist endorsing Hillary to show how much they hate Trump. We had that ridiculous charade when we had a parliamentary motion to ban Donald Trump from Britain after he made the statement about a temporary ban on Muslims entering America. And we can't resist telling Americans how stupid they are for supporting Donald Trump. And therefore, I think most politicians will say how much they like Hillary.
Christopher, is Hillary to the left of Barack Obama or to the right of him?
It's a good question. What does she stand for? Now, one ought to know, after being on terms of, they call it public intimacy with a particular figure. But the problem is, one doesn't know. Her political schema, if you will, isn't so much a template as a palimpsest. She's, you know, she's for something until she's against it. It's hard to tell. She will have to lurch to the left if she wants to get the Bernie Sanders kids. No one is enthusiastic about Clinton, even the people who love her. She's going to have to do some fancy footwork, and she's going to be dancing really all over the map, I think.
Isn't someone who is dull and a bit predictable exactly what America and the world needs, given the alternative?
Yeah, I mean, I think as Christopher's brilliant piece points out, yes, this is the grim option facing America, but it's probably the most sensible option is to plump for Hillary. But it's not a pretty picture. And as Christopher says, you know, if you think Americans are angry now, wait for 4 years of Hillary, and this could lead to an even more sinister finger than Donald Trump.
And Christopher, final question. Given that America is a country of 300 million ingenious souls, you're now having to choose between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Is it safe for us Brits to conclude that the experiment of American self-government has failed and it's now time for the return of some British control?
I would call that, to use a Clintonian term, triangulation on a very high scale. but I would not rule out a strongly royalist sentiment. I understand Ireland has designated and some Ireland off its coast as a refuge, a safe room, as it were, for disaffected Americans. It may turn out to be a very populated island.
Next, Tristram Hunt in The Spectator this week says that Labour needs to stop being scared of patriotism. The MP for Stoke argues that too many in his party feel queasy about our national identity, and says that in language and in policy, Labour needs to show that it loves England once again in order to win back voters. The Spectator's political editor, James Forsyth, spoke to Tristram. Here's what he had to say.
It does seem on the constitution, Tristram, that Labour are in a bind. But in Scotland, Labour came third because it essentially ran a campaign which tried to avoid the national constitutional question at a time when that is the issue that dominates Scottish politics. And in England, Labour seemed to want to not even engage, the Labour leadership seemed to want to engage with this whole question of what is English identity in this kind of post-devolution era when you've got a government in Scotland and an assembly in Cardiff. Why do you think Labour is so uncomfortable with the idea of English identity?
I think there are some broad trends and then some more narrow political ones. I think the Labour Party historically has been really the only credibly British party with very strong representation in Wales, Scotland, England, obviously Northern Ireland is a different case. And so when you see Britishness under threat, when you see the rise of stronger national identities in Scotland and Wales and England, I think that put a lot of pressure on the politics of Labour and Labourism. You're right to address the issue of constitutionalism. The Labour Party thought if we just focused on social and economic public policy in Scotland, actually the merits of the union would be obvious in a sense, would shine through, exactly. And as a result, we weren't really on the pitch in terms of constitutional questions, when actually, for large numbers of voters in Scotland, this was the case. Now, there's a very strong argument to be made about the union, about social democracy, about the connection between, you know, people in Glasgow and Stoke. But we also have to realise that questions of identity and national identity are stronger and stronger, and we have to have an answer to them. And that goes to a point about England and Englishness. We're much more relaxed in the Labour Party talking about Scottish identity. We're relaxed in the Labour Party talking about Britishness and a kind of civic nationalism there. But there is a strand in our party which is uncomfortable about England and Englishness.
Do you think that's because Englishness still has a kind of ethnic connotation to it in a way that Britishness doesn't now?
Yes. Britishness as an identity allows sort of multiple layers, so Black British, Pakistani British, allows both the sort of heritage identity and the modern civic identity. Englishness has a connotation of white ethnicity. Now, as I point out in the piece, you know, the journalist Gary Young has argued very persuasively that actually some of that is beginning to break down, particularly in the Black community. But I think you're right. That's one of the elements why there's a kind of squeamishness about Englishness, because it bespeaks a kind of monocultural identity.
Do you think there's also an element that people see Englishness as a kind of provincial identity? While as Labour is becoming a much more kind of urban party, you know, Labour is the party of the cities, Englishness is a kind of county identity.
I think there's a bit of that, but I also think there's just a kind of post-colonial angst about that sort of England was this dominant imperial force. There's almost an apologism about Englishness. And I think that then connects to the kind of cosmopolitan identity you see in urban areas. So it's both the need to apologise for the history, and then where Labour's vote is today.
I mean, the argument on federalism has always been that England is just too big, and that is the problem. And it seems that this government's answer is essentially these kind of regional city deals, and that you can then devolve to Manchester or Merseyside, and that gets over the kind of problem that England is too big. Do you think that is enough?
I think we need to be clear about, in a sense, multiple pathways. One pathway is an English Parliament and a referendum on an English Parliament. Another pathway is to say we solve the sort of English question, the dominance of the English question, by these big city deals, which also in the case of East Anglia are sort of non-urban deals. And actually, if you devolve power out of Westminster and Whitehall to Manchester City region or the West Midlands or Bristol in the South West, that is an answer to it. And I think you can make a credible intellectual case for that. My criticism would be that we in the Labour Party seem to be equivocating about that as well. We're not saying we're in favour of the Metro Mayors or against. We're going to have our own constitutional convention to discuss all this. But I think it's a perfectly credible answer to the English question. But if it is the answer, well, then we need to be more full throttle about it.
So are you in favour of kind of Andy Burnham going off to be mayor of Manchester and Luciana Berger going to be mayor of Liverpool and all this, you know?
I think it's totally brilliant. I think it is a sign when frontline politicians choose to leave Westminster, as, you know, Boris and Sadiq and Zach chose to do for London. If frontline politicians in Westminster think that actually I can influence my community more and do more as a mayor, I think that shows devolution is working. And so in the last parliament, Liam Byrne thought he might go for Birmingham until Birmingham rejected it. We've heard Andy thinking about Manchester. I think that's really exciting. And also, it's exciting for the Labour Party because we will be in power in these cities delivering progressive outcomes.
Do you think these city deals and the like, can they satisfy the emotional desire for identity that Englishness seems to fill for a large section of the population?
Oh, that's very interesting. I don't know, because actually these cities are consciously global entities. You know, you think of what Manchester is about now, and it's about, you know, the Etihad and connections with the Middle East. It's about the visit of the Chinese president. Actually, Manchester positions itself, as it was, as Cotonopolis was, as a global city. So whether that answers the cultural need for a stronger English identity, I'm not sure. And that might be a valid criticism of what is a social and economic programme rather than maybe a cultural one.
Do you think, on an English Parliament, do you worry, you know, as an MP, do you worry that the English First Minister would end up being more important than the Prime Minister?
I think you would end up with a situation where, more often than not, I mean, if it was a Conservative one, they would be one and the same.
What, so you would allow them to double hat?
Well, I think all of that needs to be on the table. The It seems to me here we're heading towards that situation whereby, you know, we flip into an English Parliament on English votes, English laws. You still have the Prime Minister in charge of the governing party of that English Parliament, but it's very Gilbert and Sullivan. We don't really know, you know, when it's happening, how it's happening. It's suddenly, you know, we flip into committee and then we're out of it again. You know, we're about to have this extraordinary refurbishment of the Palace of Westminster, a kind of, you know, year zero approach to what we do in this place. Should provision be made within that for chambers which might allow in time an English Parliament? I think, you know, that might be part of the conversation.
Do you think a Scot will ever be Prime Minister again?
Yes, I do. And I think the way through on all this is you can sort of slice and dice the UK up, but I still think if you had the leader of a political party from Wales or Scotland or England with a totally compelling vision of the future of Britain, which all parts of the country could buy into, then actually the political dynamic would take care of itself. And, you know, we've seen that in the past, and I think we'll see it again in the future. You know, I'm a believer in the union. I'm absolutely a believer in the union. But I think we in the Labour Party are out of kilter with the times if we don't give stronger space to expressions of national belonging and identity.
And just finally, do you think there's a class element? There's an amazing quote in your piece when someone said it's like a Ryanair flight, that, you know, you basically have to put up with the working class to get where you want to go to, and that is how some people in the Labour Party think about. Do you think there is an element of class, a bit of class distaste for the kind of people who like the St George's Cross and all that?
There is an element of class in it, certainly. I don't think that's particular to the Labour Party. I think when you see the levels now of sort of exclusivity of those joining political parties, what we don't have are the broad mass membership of parties with the full reflection. And I was very struck by Susie Stride's comments, you know, rooted in the community in Harlow, because it was a key seat. You have these activists coming in from across the country. And in the essay in the book, she describes how when they were asked, you know, who read The Sun, only one person out of, you know, 25 put up their hand, and there was sniggering about them.
They should all read The Sun.
Those who they seek to represent read The Sun. They should understand that, and to have any air, I think, of sort of condescension or patronising sensibility towards it is death.
And finally, on to poetry. Or more specifically, the Spectator's competition to write a limerick for President Erdogan. Being rude about him can land you in jail in Turkey. But when a German comedian was persecuted by the authorities for writing a rude poem about Erdogan, it made Douglas Murray worry about the state of freedom of expression in Europe. Douglas joins me now. Douglas, can you take up the story of what happened?
Of course. Well, at the end of March, when comedian Jan Böhmermann appeared on German television and read a very rude poem about President Erdogan of Turkey, one might have expected that such a poem could land you in trouble in Turkey, but the idea that it could land you in trouble in Germany in the 21st century is extraordinary. And yet the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, and others approved the prosecution of this German comedian for reading a poem on German television that was rude about Erdogan. And that comedian now faces the potential of years in jail in Germany. So it is my belief that when such a thing occurs, so when such an outrage occurs, it's the job of all free-thinking people to immediately cause what I believe is known as the Streisand effect, named after, of course, the singer Barbara Streisand and her inability, as it turned out, to keep her photographs of her house private. Anyhow, which means that then everybody starts to look at the house on the internet. So it was my belief that we should all start to do that. We should all start to write rude poems about President Erdogan. I spent a weekend doing it and did a not bad effort in limerick form, and then opened it out to readers last month, and was delighted to discover that thousands upon thousands of people from all around the world, young and old, retirees, children. We got entries from people who'd written very rude limericks with the help of their mothers in some cases. And all of these people flooded in from all around the world in different languages. We had entries in German, entries in English, of course, entries in Turkish, entries in Arabic. There was such a demand that I think this actually makes President Erdogan, who's obviously trying to stop anyone anywhere in the world insulting him, actually the world's most insulted president.
And Douglas, I understand that we now have a winner.
We do. Now, I have one sad announcement to make in advance. Many entries and entrants to this fine competition will feel that they have been robbed. Because very early on, I did point out that the rhyme that many people were attempting for Ankara was not quite correct. That it was nearly a word, the one that they were striving towards, they were grasping for, but it wasn't quite a word. A lot of people objected to this. A lot of people sent in poems with this particular rhyme for Ankara anyway. But I had said that they might be discounted. So anyhow, people will feel possibly a little aggrieved. But this is the winning entry, and it's titled To a Turkish President. There was a young fellow from Ankara who was a terrific wankerer, till he sowed his wild oats with the help of a goat, but it didn't even stop to thank her.
And who's that by?
That is by former Mayor of London, Boris Johnson.
Out of the thousands of entries, what was it that you particularly liked about Boris's poem?
Well, other entrants may feel a little aggrieved about this. Firstly, for the point I made about the Ankara rhyme, which had been disbarred. Secondly, for the technical problem that some people will notice, that oats and goat is generally unsatisfactory. It should either be the plural in both cases or in neither. I'm sure that Boris Johnson appreciates this, but nevertheless, I thought that the vim and the vigour of the entry was one thing. The other is that in awarding this prize to Boris Johnson, it's entirely anti-meritocratic. I should state that there were very, very many entries which were at least as fine. We had entries in heroic couplets. Some people sent in whole pages of Homeric odes to do with Erdogan's notorious untrustworthiness in the vicinity of a public zoo. But this one really caught me because it was by Boris Johnson. And I thought that the it's a very important thing if you are going to insult President Erdogan. Not only that those of us asserting our right as citizens do this, but also that lawmakers do this. You see, it seems to me the finest thing possible that in the United Kingdom, in Great Britain, in 2016, you can award a prize to a political leader for insulting the despot in Ankara, whilst in Germany in 2016, a political leader tries to slam people up in prison. So it's a moral point more than a poetic one, I think. That isn't to diss Boris's poetic skill.
And how do you think Erdogan's going to react to the news that Boris has penned this poem?
Well, you see, the normal response one should make to a poem you don't like about yourself is to write an equally rude poem back. So if I were President Erdogan of Turkey at this stage, I would be trying to think of rhymes for Johnson and fire a limerick straight back. To my mind, the most important thing of this whole thing, I mean, so far we've had a lot of fun with this Erdogan insulting poetry competition because some really filthy-minded people have written in, and I'm very grateful to them. And it's been great fun, but there's also the very important point behind it, which is that we are free people, and we are able to say what we think about somebody like Erdogan. Somebody who imprisons journalists in his own country, tries to lock them up in Germany, that we will maintain the right to continue to say what we think of him, that he will not be immune from criticism. And I would hope that if Erdogan has any sense, he would realise that his attempt to stifle any criticism or insult of himself worldwide has made him a worldwide laughingstock. I would hope he would further take the lesson that he should not try to clamp down on freedom of expression, not in Turkey and not across the rest of the world, that it's intolerable that he should do such a thing, that he should go back to his palace, he should mull on this, and he should realise that in actual fact, genuinely free societies allow people to say what they think, including things that are rude. And I would hope that President Erdogan considers this to be a very light spanking.
That's all for this week. You can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes Store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And a reminder that podcast listeners can also enjoy a special subscription rate of 22 issues for £22 by going to spectator.co.uk/22.